U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
If that song is playing, it must be Friday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here, high atop the Chicago River in the Skyline Studio for WGN Radio. Thanks very much for tuning in. Ron Onesti will be here later in the program. You know, he's the guy behind the Arcata in St. Charles, but so much more. I was in a club in Highwood and saw that he just purchased that, so I want to talk to him a little bit about the club business, the restaurant business in Chicago. I will start things off by talking transportation, though, in L.A., of all places, and then we'll bring that home. On a phone line now is Philip Washington. He is the CEO of L.A. Metro. Philip, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
I don't know if you had a chance to hear our traffic report just a few minutes ago, but we've got our hot spots, too.
Right. Oh, yeah. I heard that, and it made me a little homesick. I'm from Chicago.
Oh, I did not realize that.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about, there was news, the L.A. news in Chicago today, and I just want to get your impression, if you have an impression, but Charlie Beck was named as the interim police superintendent here. You know, our superintendent announced his retirement yesterday. What can Chicagoans expect from Beck?
I think Charlie Beck is a really, really good man. We worked very, very closely together when he was in Los Angeles here. He will be great for Chicago. Community policing is his thing. And the crime rate in L.A. has dropped during his tenure. He'll be good for the city of Chicago.
How much does community policing involve mass transportation?
We have, in terms of our law enforcement structure, we have a three-agency model that we contract with, the Los Angeles Police Department, the Long Beach Police Department, and the L.A. County Sheriffs. And so on our system, they are on our system. There's a lot of community policing that take place on our system. We do not have them doing fair compliance, though. We have our own security team doing fair compliance.
You completed a study, and it drew the attention of my great producer here, Bennett Wakenight, about women in transportation in L.A. I have to tell you, my daughter lives in L.A. I just texted her. I was going to talk to you, and she says she's eager for the Wilshire line to be completed.
Yes, we are doing that Wilshire line that will go through UCLA all the way west to our VA hospital. That line, we're building it in three sections, and it's almost done.
But you looked at women in particular when it comes to mass transportation. Why? What is it about women that need to be studied?
Well, first of all, we created what I call a Women and Girls Governing Council to look at various issues. And one of the issues they looked at was understanding how women travel. Women make up the majority of the riders out here in Los Angeles on our buses and trains. We move about 1.3 million people a day. Our system is not unlike Chicago Transit Authority, CTA. More than 5.2 million women and girls live in L.A. County of the 10 million people that live in this county. So we felt the need, and the Women and Girls Council brought this forward to say we should study, you know, the issues with women and girls traveling on our system. And so that's how that came about. We did not have a lot of data on, you know, issues involving women, and so this study accomplished that.
Do women travel differently than men?
We think so. We think so. Women have, you know, sometimes small children. There's issues with design changes at bus stops. Bus stops may be dark. There's women that may have to drop their kids off at daycare and then head to work. So we think they do travel differently, and there's different safety sort of perceptions, and there's different issues with regard to having a visible security presence going forward. They also take more short trips during the day, and so they may be traveling not during the ordinary peak period periods of morning and evening. They may be traveling during the day doing various things on shorter trips.
I thought it was interesting, right, that they tended to make chain trips from one stop to the next to the next to the next during the day, more
That's
so
correct.
Than men. Now that you have this information, what do you do with it?
We are putting together an action plan to address the issues that we discovered. And let me just say that there's a lot of bright spots in this report as well. What we determine is women are nearly as likely as men to be satisfied with our services, too. So we have an action plan that we have put together. We are looking to implement that action plan to address the issues that came out of the study, more lighting at bus stops, all kinds of different things, you know, how women address strollers when they get on the bus. All of these things, we have an action plan that we are looking to implement. And I'll say this, too. I mean, these issues are not unique to Metro. One of the things that we got a call not long ago from Washington, D.C., the system in Washington, asking about our study. So these things, what we're doing here can be replicated all over the country.
I was going to ask you, right, so we're benefiting from your former police chief today, but we may well benefit as well from your study of women commuters tomorrow.
That's right. That's exactly right. And Chief Beck knows kind of what we were doing out here and some of the things we were looking at with how women travel as well.
Philip Washington, the CEO of LA Metro. Philip, it was great to talk to you, especially now that I know you're talking to your hometown. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. And a shout out to Argyle Gardens on the far south side of the city where I'm from.
There you go. Thanks very much, Philip.
Right.
Be well. It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, you know, right, that if the federal government orders a recall of a child's toy or something for safety reasons, the stores that sell them have to pull them off the shelves. They can't resell them. But did you know that also applies to private resale, say eBay or Facebook marketplaces like that? That's something that Consumer Reports looked into. On the phone line is Rachel Rabkin Peachman. She's an investigative journalist and deputy of special projects at Consumer Reports. And she's found that deadly products are being sold at places like eBay. Rachel, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
So let's just tell the story through the product that you highlight at the beginning, this Fisher-Price Rock and Play Sleeper. It was found to be fatal for children.
Exactly, yes. This product has been linked to over 70 infant deaths, and it had nothing to do with how the parents used it necessarily, but the product itself is inherently dangerous. So it was recalled from the marketplace in April, but I found hundreds of them for sale on Facebook Marketplace and on Craigslist.
And the idea is that, well, I mean, I can just imagine it, places like, well, a garage sale, things like that. You can't police the garage sales, but maybe these online marketplaces you can. Is the law being, if I resell that, am I in violation or is Facebook Marketplace?
You both are, actually, if you were to do that. So the individual definitely has responsibility, and it is actually illegal for an individual to post the product and sell the recalled product. But, you know, these online marketplaces have a moral obligation, too, as well as a legal obligation to up their policies and improve their systems so that they're able to flag these sale posts and prevent people from selling the recalled goods.
And you found that they haven't been doing that?
Well, Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist didn't respond to my request for comment, so I don't know exactly what they're doing on their end, but they're not enforcing something because I can see these products for sale. They do have policies that are on their websites that you can read about, but clearly people are able to sort of fly under the radar and get these products posted anyway. But on the other hand, eBay is doing, it seems, a better job of enforcing this. They have the same policies that, you know, users are not allowed to sell recalled goods, but they have automated systems. They have filtration systems and image recognition, keyword searches that help flag dangerous products and then keep them from the site.
So if I were to try to sell on Facebook Marketplace this Fisher-Price Rock and Roll Play Sleeper, and I advertise it by that name, it would likely get Well, you said you had sellers say that got caught.
Yeah, it seems that they have some tools in place that sometimes say you can't sell this product as is, but then people rename it. They may not be aware that it's recalled, and they may just think, oh, my post didn't go through, and that's actually what has happened to some users we've talked to. And then they rename it, you know, Baby Bouncer or Baby Sleeper or, you know, Fisher-Price Rocker, and it goes through.
And they may be doing, well, I don't know, are they doing that innocently, or are they just trying to get, I guess they got flagged for one reason, and they're just trying to get it back on the market.
Yeah, I've seen both instances. I've seen users post something online, and then someone has alerted them and said, hey, this product is recalled. And, of course, you know, maybe it's a parent says, goodness, I wouldn't want to hurt anyone else. I'll take the product down. But then there, I've certainly seen other cases where people post it knowingly. And some have even said, I know that this has been recalled, you know, but I'm trying, you know, it was great. I loved it, which is illegal and dangerous and potentially deadly.
Is government involved here? I see that Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut is writing some stern letters.
Yes, legislators have called on some of these websites to step up their game and make a change. And the Consumer Product Safety Commission says that they survey these sites and try to flag items that shouldn't be sold. But, you know, at this point, we're not seeing this problem solved.
Were you surprised by what you found?
I was surprised. I figured I'd find some recalled products. I mean, even the best systems, you can't prevent everything, but I was really shocked by the sheer number of Rock and Play sleepers that we found.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's, I mean, that's what you look for, but that's a serious thing. This isn't a, I mean, there have been fatalities here. This is a big deal.
Absolutely, and it's been, you know, advertised, this recall, and the media attention that the recall has gotten has been out there. So you would think that people would know about it. But it wasn't just that product. I also found recalled IKEA dressers, and I found recalled Bumbo seats, which are a type of baby seat. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, a lot of people who maybe are not aware of recalls.
If I am shopping on Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist or wherever, and I see something that has specifically been recalled, is there a way that I could flag that for the site that others would know it would be recalled?
There's not a way on Facebook to specifically note that something has been recalled, as far as we can tell. You know, legislators have asked for that to happen, and I don't believe it's happened yet. But you could report it to Facebook as, you know, a thing that they need to look into as a danger, and you certainly could email the seller and let that person know. And also, it's just a wise practice as a buyer. If you're considering buying something used, especially a baby product that should be up to standards, you know, to look at recalls.gov to make sure that it hasn't been recalled.
It's not hard to find out, right? It is something that you can find out.
Yeah, exactly.
Rachel Rabkin-Peachman, investigative journalist, deputy of special projects at Consumer Reports. Listen, good work on this. I'm glad you're bringing it to light. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. In the studio now is Ron Onesti, and you probably know the name. I immediately think of the Arcata Theater in St. Charles. Ron, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
I am so excited to be with the great Steve Bertrand
here, man.
Honest to God.
Say more. I'll wait.
Well, you know what?
No, that's enough. Okay.
It speaks to Chicago. You're one of the Chicago guys, and I'm all about the neighborhood.
Well, I appreciate that. But I was at a bar in Highwood that I've been to, you know, several times. It's the 210 Live, I think it's called.
Yes.
And I was seeing a band, Not For Profit, that I like to watch. And all of a sudden, I see that Onesti owns this place, too. And I really hadn't thought about how many different spots you're in.
Yeah.
I mean, tell me about your domain.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, they know the gem of our crown, I guess, is the Arcata Theater in St. Charles. And above that on the third floor is a 1920s speakeasy that is actually between Howie Mandel, Paul Anka, and Billy Gibbons and ZZ Top, all their favorite place to eat and hang out.
Nice.
So there's that going on. And I'm very, very excited about the Highwood location. You know, it's actually called Club 210 Live now.
Oh, you changed the name.
Of Highwood. Yeah, okay. You know what? Give it a little bit of a difference. But, you know, we're going to build on the foundation that they had there of live music, except we're going to add a couple things. I'm changing up the decor a little bit. We're going to add, I put the kitchen back in, got all my recipes, and bring a little touch of national stardom to the place.
So if you're a restaurant in Highwood, you've got competition there.
Those are brothers and sisters of the business. That's all I see it as.
Tell me about moving into a space and trying to figure out what's going to work. And we can do it through 210. But, just in general, when you open up something.
You know what, Steve? I'd love to come up with some charts and graphs and some big formula here. But I'm 57. And I'm not an old guy, but I'm not 21 either.
Right.
And I just pretty much do the stuff that I like. And ironically, it kind of speaking to a couple of generations. Like everybody says, I love all kinds of music. Well, I really do. But it's that classic rock. It's that 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s that everybody seems to love.
But you don't want to get, so you want to have an emphasis or a theme, but you don't want to, beat people over the head with it either, right?
Exactly.
That would keep people away.
Well, I pride myself and my staff as well, and I have a great support crew, about the variety of things we could do. In any one week, for example, at the Arcata Theater, you can have Bret Michaels of Poison, then Queensryche, then Engelbert Humperdinck, and then, Howie Mandel, all in the same week. We did that last week.
How's the audience? Well, how do you draw?
You know what? We've got a marketing machine. We just get it out there, and obviously social media. But we've established a community that loves this stuff. I've been doing it for a bunch of years now. I'm 35 years in the business, and we've established again a culture of people that just love what we have.
And so you have the live music there. You're going to have live music at 210 as well.
Oh, absolutely.
But those are going to be bands that we've heard of, not just local bands.
Yeah, you'll have a lot of local bands that you've heard of.
Right.
Like 16 Candle, Seventh Heaven, those kind of things that really, really draw. But we also have national touring tributes to everything from Steely Dan to Billy Joel to Led Zeppelin to Pink Floyd. And then you're going to have some national acts, too. I've got a very unique opportunity with the bigger places that I have. And I'll tell you about Displays in a second. but with the bigger places
that I
have.
What, you just bought something while we started the interview?
Yeah, actually, in the elevator. It was weird. This guy, he pulled open his jacket. He had watches and a theater. And I don't know.
Okay, but tell me about the position you're and how the Arcata can influence who plays at 210.
Exactly. Between the corporate events I have and the Arcata Theater, it's like this. Hey, national act, I'm going to give you your money, your price for it to play my big place, but, you're probably going to be sitting in the hotel room the night before. So I've got a smaller venue of people that love the live music. Why don't we do something that makes sense for both of us rather than you sit in the hotel room and my place sits empty.
Right.
And you know what? These guys, giving them two or three gigs in a weekend and allowing them to stay in the same hotel, that's a big deal.
I'm thinking when there's the Viper Alley, which was in Vernon Hills or
Lincolnshire. Yes, it was up there.
Didn't succeed. I mean, there's risk here.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of risk. There really is. But again, I don't know the whole history. I was at Viper Alley, and a friend of mine, Paul, had a great deal to do with it. But all I can say is that, I'm with all the different properties and opportunities. There's festivals that we own. There's corporate events that we do. So, for example, ZZ Top, it's their 50th anniversary, and it's very hard to get ZZ Top in a 900-seat theater.
Right.
I won't get ZZ Top, probably, but Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, I'm doing a corporate event with him in Las Vegas, and because of that, and he's definitely getting his money for that, I'll stop by the Arcata and do a show.
All right, what's up in Des Plaines?
So, Des Plaines Theater and people of Des Plaines know that, they've had this property in downtown Des Plaines since 1927, around the era, we were open in 1926 at the Arcata. So there's several of these 1920s vaudevillian Prohibition era buildings.
Right.
That had just gone by the wayside. And that's what happened to Des Plaines. But I have to credit the municipality, the mayor, the city council, the village manager, the city manager over there in Des Plaines to realizing, number one, the value of these old buildings, and number two, the effect and the impact, the economic impact it can have.
So you're going to open up an Arcata-like theater there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's going to be another situation where the Des Plaines Theater is close enough and far enough to allow me to do maybe a Friday night with this one at the Arcata and maybe a Saturday in Des Plaines.
When is that going to happen?
Well, it's happening right now. Every week I'm there with the staff and we're designing it. I mean, they basically said, hey, you just show us what you want and what's going to be the best way. I'm putting two restaurant concepts in there along with a speakeasy again. And we're just designing it every week. So we're looking maybe August, September.
Okay, great. And you mentioned Des Plaines being welcoming. That's one of the things about Highwood, too. I mean, Highwood's just a pretty remarkable town, I think.
Yeah, Des Plaines, Highwood. I mean, there are municipalities that are welcoming. They're nice. But then there are those other ones that really get, again, economic impact of what we're trying to accomplish. And also quality of life, how it adds to their community.
Okay, so it's working for you. How do you see the industry as a whole in the area? I mean, Are there trends? Are we on the upswing? Or, you know, give me a picture of the entertainment industry here.
Well, you know, I can give you another hour on that, obviously, just like in many industries. But basically what it is, it's the sense of competition. You look everywhere you go. You've got small clubs. You've got your House of Blues. You've got the Live Nation. You got all Jam, of course. You got all these great people who've been putting on these shows. And it's just a level of competition. And also the suburban venues have really stepped up as well. They see what we're doing. And I'm not saying they're patenting themselves, but it's,
right.
You know, I've had one
works,
guy.
It works, right? We'll watch it, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to mention the venue, but the guy who runs one suburban venue said, hey, I don't even talk to agents anymore. I look at your calendar and I book what you got.
You know, and you speak to your age. I'm about your age too. And you get to a point where you want it to be less work to go see the music.
Oh, that's it. It's
and
completely,
that's what this is.
Completely experiential. Yeah. It can't be, you know, the days of standing up and 3-4 hours before a show and you know what, it's you got to get there, you got to have parking, got to, and you know, it's ironic we say that because the Arcata Theater, being almost 100 years old, has been challenged with HVAC, has been challenged with restrooms, but I'm so proud that we are right in the middle of a $2 million renovation, adding two more restaurant concepts, adding HVAC, adding restrooms. It's just going to be incredible.
Ron Onesti doesn't stop. I'm glad you stopped by here to talk a little bit.
I am twice as glad, Mr. Bertrand.
And nice to finally meet you.
Finally.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Airbnb has been making some headlines lately, but probably not for the way that they wanted to. Chicago was one of the reasons for that, after a number of Chicago Airbnb hosts were scamming renters by listing an Airbnb, saying it's unavailable last minute, and providing an inferior place to stay. It's forcing Airbnb to check all 7 million listings to make sure that they're up to standards and proving they offer what they say. 7 million listings! That's going to take some time, but something tells me those people who have to go to Bali to check on the listings aren't going to be too disappointed. But Chicagoans are feeling a little disappointed because they'll be funding most of the bill for the new CTU teaching contract. The Chicago Public Schools may need to lean on the assistance from the city for a mere $100 million. And that will come from, you guessed it, state aid and property taxes. This goes back to the old ways of finding solutions for the city and state money problems. Just make the residents pay for it. But you gotta ask yourself, how much more can residents take? I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, O just said unknown destinations, and maybe that will bring me right into my interview this afternoon with Dalton Barker, who writes about restaurants and other things for Crane Chicago Business. Dalton, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve. How are you this afternoon?
Great, thanks. Okay, undisclosed locations. That has to do with this story. I did not know much about this story until I read yours yesterday. This restaurant, is it pronounced Embeya? Yeah,
that's close enough. That's close. I'm not the best person when it comes to pronunciation, so I really shouldn't throw rocks.
Well, it's okay. You're a print guy, right? I'm
exactly.
Radio. I should know.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah, but I mean, you know, this was a story that, you know, when it opened in 2012, you know, it was one of the hotter restaurants in Chicago. And, you know, I think that people always love kind of stories like this because it kind of unveils the curtain of kind of what happens in some of these business deals. And this one was just kind of a really strange one in general. And Ateli Goulet, he admitted to U.S. District Court the other day that he basically defrauded shareholders and used some of the money for a legal wire fraud scheme. And that's one of the bigger, more bizarre stories. You know, the last time he was identified before he was apprehended was in Spain. So he kind of just, you know, flew the coop with hundreds of thousands of dollars and just left a couple years ago. And now he's finally been brought to justice.
So the restaurant, was the restaurant open when they fled, or did it fail and then he fled?
It failed as soon. It failed, and he took off.
Okay.
It kind of all happened very quickly, all at once. And I believe that they actually found his vehicle abandoned at the time too, which was just another one of those bizarre kind of things that all kind of culminated into yesterday's guilty plea.
How did they end up finding him?
From what I understand, I don't know the exact details about how he was apprehended, but I know there was last February, there was an arrest warrant for him, basically because of the probable cause was enough to establish this. And he was, I think eventually he was staying in a private home and on a 10-day vacation, and then he got an extradition order from the FBI.
And was his wife charged as well?
His wife was charged as well, yeah.
And so now we know the story of Mbeya, we'll go with, and that's all been resolved. I guess were the investors ever made whole or probably not?
From what I understand, no. But again, all the investors, it's kind of hard to kind of pull back the curtain of exactly what was lost and what was not lost.
Right.
So that was just kind of an interesting, you know, obviously some of these things happened before. We've had stories where, you know, people have been, you know, have ripped off fellow investors. But this is kind of an interesting one just because of kind of where he was found. He was found in Spain. And I remembered correctly, he was arrested in Valencia, Spain.
Okay.
So it was just one of these things where it's kind of a global fine for this guy.
Well, and two, when a guy just disappears like that, it's pretty amazing. Hey, we got less than a minute, but you writing about McDonald's too, and the new CEO there, Chris Kay, he's called at McDonald's headquarters, not a friend of the franchisees or hasn't been, and that's going to be a challenge for him.
Yeah, I mean, I want to cut a little bit hedge too. I mean, he has done some things where cash flow has improved for franchisees, which has been a big thing for him, but McDonald's is a really interesting place because they've made it, the franchisees have these big investments into technology, especially speeding up drive-through times. And because of that, they've had to take on a higher debt leverage than they've had in previous years. So really, I kind of wrote a story a couple weeks ago, 2020 is a big year for McDonald's. They're doing well compared to the Burger Kings and Wendy's of the world, but they really need to improve store traffic, which is kind of a big barometer because you can only sell so many things to a dwindling number of people for so long before it comes
back
to bite you.
The franchisees want a nice chicken sandwich, don't they?
Exactly, they do. And we might be seeing, who knows, in terms of a Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods burger. That's something their competitors are doing, and I know that analysts are wondering where is that coming from McDonald's as well.
Dalton Barker writes about that at Mord Cranes. Check him out at chicagobusiness.com. Dalton, great to talk to you today.
Thanks so much, Steve.